This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Maggie Rogers came on the music scene in 2016 when she was 22 years old and had a viral hit song called Alaska.
I was walking through icy streams that took my breath away. Moving slowly through westward water over glacial plains.
Rogers' debut album wound up on a lot of best of lists, and this summer, she released a much anticipated follow-up called Surrender.
And I don't know if this is considered a hot take in this room, but I think it's even better. Please, let's remind her how excited we are to have her in this building and on this stage, Maggie Rogers.
Staff writer Kelly Fasane welcomed Rogers to the stage at a New Yorker Live event just a couple of weeks ago. And the evening was something special because she was there to talk with a mentor of hers, a musical legend, the renowned hip-hop artist, producer, and bandleader, Questlove. Now let's turn things over to Kelly Fasane.
I knew about Questlove way back when he was merely considered the greatest drummer in the history of hip-hop. That was a long time ago. Okay. These days, he's everywhere. Co-founder of The Roots, musical director of The Tonight Show, six-time Grammy winner, recent Oscar winner. And the director of a forthcoming Sly Stone movie. I can't wait. Many of us think of Questlove as a kind of musical professor. But Maggie, he was actually your professor.
Yeah.
At NYU. What did you learn?
Nothing.
It was pretty remarkable. It was my senior year of college. Mm-hmm. And I was taking a class on Michael Jackson's Thriller. Mm. And in the middle of the class, Prince died. Mm. And so it also became a class that was really about 1999 and Thriller. And I think it was the week that we were studying the correlation between the two records.
Right.
And yeah, it was awesome.
You're making me feel really old. In my day, we had nothing like that in college.
I mean, I think it was a very specific, like, NYU, like, we're going to do the thing course.
In my day, we had nothing like that. Yeah. I had to create it, so.
Yeah, you know. And thank you for doing that, yeah.
Do you remember Maggie? What impression did you have of her
do
back
you?
Then?
Yeah.
You know, it's weird. You know what's weird about that particular class? Because there are so many standouts. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Take a Day Trip guys who produce
All the Lil Nas X.
And that was the first time in which I was like in my head. By the second week, I was like, oh no, these students are smarter than I am. And like normally I'm kind of a know-it-all in this very specific area, but it's like now I have to go home and do 3-hour studies on certain synth patches and drum machines and all those things.
I was going to say, I would think it would be impossible to stump you. You talked about like Michael Jackson and Prince. What's the discussion like when you're talking about musicians like that?
There's a general theme that initially I was doing a study on. I'm really obsessed with why people sabotage momentum. And a lot of times artists might be in a position where they get to a particular pinnacle and then they do something called the departure album, which is kind of a cutesy artistic way of saying, I'm scared to, you know, attempt this Thelma and Louise jump over a mountain cliff. And so, especially with the Thriller situation, I asked a question last year beforehand, which is basically like, how many of you are familiar with Thriller? Like, at least have heard it. And most of the answers of those 28 students were sort of like, yeah, my grandmom has that record. So it's like only like 6 of them maybe heard it once or twice or 3 times. So I thought that was a sort of an interesting way to go.
But, I had never really listened to Prince before.
Right.
Which I grew up in like rural Maryland. There was a lot of bluegrass growing up. My parents weren't super into music. My little brother has really sensitive hearing. Like there were all these reasons where there was sometimes a lot of music if it was just me and my mom. And then I got to music really like self-discovery as I was growing up. And it was so sick to hear Prince for the first time as like a 22-year-old in your class.
I can't imagine being a college kid. Questlove is your professor, and he assigns you
it's
Prince.
It's pretty magic.
He's like, I think you're going to like this record.
I didn't even pull out the bells and whistles. Like the first year, like the Beastie Boys came for like finals, and I had Wendy and Lisa from the Revolutions come in and teach class. And then
that's insane.
Did D'Angelo come to...
Not my class.
Okay, that was the year before. Like, by the fourth or fifth year, I felt confident enough that I didn't have to pull out any bells or whistles. So, sorry about that, Mac.
I mean...
But I definitely remember your version of Billie Jean really made an impression.
Oh, my God.
No, but it made an impression on me and Harry, my co-teacher.
That's so funny. Yeah.
Harry Wagner.
I completely forgot about this.
Who runs, like, Universal's...
he's amazing.
Reissue.
Yeah. So wait, you.
The assignment was to remake Billie Jean, my.
But she did a departure version of it.
I chose to go yacht rock.
And that's when I realized, like, oh damn, she.
Thank you.
I think she might. She might be the ones because I was often wondering, like, of all my students, which one is, you know, like, will I be backstage in 10 years? Like, Questlove. Okay, I'll wait out here. Like.
Questlove, talking with his former student, Maggie Rogers, at a New Yorker Live event earlier this month in Manhattan. Staff writer Kelly Fasane hosted. And just ahead, we'll hear a live performance from Maggie Rogers.
The more you wait, the more you break, the longer that it takes to undo all the knots that you've been tying on cherry stems and black barbed wire too. You work all day to find religion.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. There aren't many things that I enjoy more than listening to great musicians talk about their craft and the meaning of what they're doing. So it was a real treat for me to be in the audience during this conversation between Amir Thompson, better known as Questlove, and Maggie Rogers. Some years back, Questlove was teaching at New York University, and Rogers was one of his students. In 2016, just after finishing NYU, her career took off. But after building a big reputation in the indie music world, Rogers hit pause, and she went back to school, Harvard Divinity School. So here's Rogers and Questlove, joined by the New Yorker's Kelly Fasane at a New Yorker Live event to talk about music, religion, and much more.
Well, I think in the pandemic, I started really thinking about what I wanted from my life, but also I started asking a lot of questions about what music means to me, mm-hmm. and what are the things that mean the most to me? How do I define success? What do you do with power when you have it? And the most sacred moments I've ever had in my entire life have either been on stage or in a crowd around music. Mm-hmm. But I found when I finished touring, heard it in a past life, I was so deeply burnt out. And I also, I hadn't been creative in a really long time. There was this like mismatch of trying to tour, exhausted my body and brain so that I couldn't write music, but filled my soul so much because I was feeling so connected. And the sort of third part of this was really wanting to create some sort of sustainable system for myself, hmm. where I could really think about how to move within this industry and this craft in a way that could make me as creative as possible, and in that sort of as free as possible. But also, if I really am going to sit here and talk about the spirituality of music, like, I then really need to go think about what does it look like to decide that's a spiritual discipline, and what is the relationship between the artist and the audience, and what are the ethics of holding that? So I don't know if I have a ton of answers, which is also sort of why I love studying religion, because there are no answers. But that's why I went to school.
Now I have a question.
Yeah, I bet you do.
It's like we're meeting for the first time.
Yeah, I know. It's like,
so. Well, no, I'm curious. How old were you when you truly felt like the joy and the discovery of music? Like, where just magic was happening every day, and this singer and that singer, and, you know, you're making secret tape. Well, I'm dating myself with tapes, whatever. But
the, like, magic, as I have this memory of laying on my living room floor and listening to classical music.
Okay.
And my mom told me that there was a story there, but I had to hear it. And I was just like picturing what all these instruments could mean, mm-hmm. and trying to like decode this secret language. But then, I don't know, like middle school is when I like was making tapes and was just like so deep in.
Okay. So the reason why I asked that, because I think I had to discover 2 years ago, I have to figure out where 9-year-old Amir is. you know, mm-hmm. and somehow I lost that. You know, the pandemic either meant that you were going to heed the call of the universe and realize what your destiny is and return to the essence of where you should be in life, or you're just going to sort of succumb and panic to death. And, you know, I did a little bit of both, but, you know, for me, I often tell people now, like, the goal is just to be 8 or 9 or 10 or 11.
It sounds like for both of you, there is this notion of maybe protecting yourself a little bit or finding a way to protect yourself. And you know, you mentioned Michael Jackson. I think you've talked about like Britney Spears and these people that are like consumed by their fans or their so-called fans. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder, what is that relationship, that hunger, that greed that people like me, people who love music but aren't musicians and just want a new album and want more music, what is that relationship between the fan and the musician? Are we the enemy?
If you're the enemy, I'm the enemy too, because I want that in the same way.
Right.
I mean, I think so much of my interest in this comes from having this unbelievably deep reverence for music and for process. As far as the like fan artist relationship, the word that I have become way more comfortable with other than fan is community, mm-hmm. because it to me deeply feels like an ecosystem,
right.
where, you know, when I sit down and write down my most vulnerable feelings for sport or profit, it's often this moment of when someone hears that or connects to it, it's often this moment of feeling like I'm not alone. Hmm. Like, you know what it is to be me. And the best songs communicate human emotion as simple as possible. Like, I always think about I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. Yeah. And no matter who you are, you know what that feels like. And I think that music, when it's at its best, has the ability to remind us that no matter who you are or who you voted for or what's going on in your life, you know what it's like to feel sad, or you know what it's like to feel joy. And those central emotions connect us.
But we also know that sometimes our favorite music does not come out of joy, right? Sometimes the music that we love
no.
comes out of like really hard times. And sometimes as a listener, I realize like, yeah, my favorite artists, I want them to be happy, sure. But what I really want is great music.
Not to Mary J. Blige fans. Like, if I ever seen conversation about like fans are depressed when she's happy.
Right.
But they love her when she's depressed because, you know, they're evidence sorting for their own emotions,
yeah.
which is sad that, you know, we often do that. But, yeah, you know, I don't know. For me, it's weird because even as I try to explain this to you now, I'm realizing why I taught those courses at NYU. Because I think pre-pandemic, I came from such a hard, self-deprecating place with my art that every Roots album would be a complete 180 from the album that came before. Mm. So, you know, it's almost like artists will try to ruin something, you know, like I'll quit the job before you fire me. Mm-hmm. And it really took a lot of working on myself in the pandemic to sort of ease out of that place of comfort where it's like, you know, I have to be depressed to make music or like that. Even the artists I work with, the first thing they say is like, oh man, I got to get back with my ex so I can have some arguments. And, you know, and it's so like embracing joy is such, it's almost like a taboo. But I think now, at least with this generation, like they're turning that narrative around where you have to embrace joy.
But that's Questlove the musician. Like, you're also a listener. As a listener, do you embrace joy? Or I imagine as a listener, you still love some music that is kind of dark.
You know what I do now? So I challenge, like, because now that, you know, me as the director is coming in, I think that there was a fear that I was going to lose my music Jones. Like, I had a routine where every Sunday I would listen, I would force myself to listen to any music that would be, like, a lot of times when we go on our playlist thing, it's always like we have our go-to mix. Mm-hmm. And we listen to the things that we're comfortable with and things that we know. And I'm like, okay, I want to learn new music. Like, surely there's 5,000 songs out there that can change my life. So I used to do this thing where every Sunday, I'd listen to music or buy all these records and, you know, 2 to 5 hours, just every Sunday, just listen to music and absorb it. And then once the movie happened, like, I started losing that routine and I got fearful. So now I have a new challenge where I have about 300 people that every month I have to present them 30 songs. As I say this, I'm like, wait, are you on this list?
I'm on this list.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, but for me, and these are like 300 very notable figures in the world. And to me, it's like, okay, if you can satisfy these hard-to-please artists and find 30 songs that are, like, amazing, or at least they'll connect to 2 or 3 of them,
right?
Then that will force me to keep my routine up. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, no one's asked me to do this. No one's paying me to do this, but...
It's sick.
Are there any former presidents on the list?
Yes, there are. Yeah. Ah. Well, it started with him. Like, I used to make his playlist, and then I slacked off.
This is George W. Bush you're talking about?
Bingo. I slacked off, and then I guess in the summer, it was sort of like, hey, where's my music? You know, that sort of thing. So
Maggie Rogers, Barack Obama, and 298 other people.
I'm in for that dance
party. It's an impressive list. But it keeps the pressure on for me. Mm-hmm. It's almost to the point, I know, like, half of my management team's in the audience, like, oh, that's what you're doing at night instead of working on, you know, your synopsis or whatever. But, you know, for me, like, now I'm obsessed with, by the 15th, I have to have a fresh set of 20 songs, and I'm only up to, like, 13. So when I'm done this, I'm going to dive into 1,000 more songs.
And I'm going to try and make it 301.
I'll gladly add you to the list, yeah.
Now, Maggie, how do you think about that? I mean, you take this time off, you go to Harvard Divinity School, you're thinking about what you need to just be okay and to be functional as an artist, but you make this album that, like a lot of my favorite albums, is a little bit emo, or maybe more than a little bit emo.
Well, I think that joy... What I've learned about joy is that your capacity for joy only expands with your capacity for anger. I think those emotions are really similar. They both take over your body and have this swell in this way that you have to just, or you get to just give in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a moment, so much of this record is about joy, but it's also really about anger. And there was a moment where I was saying to a friend, like, how did I become the joy girl? Like, I'm in so much trouble. Like, what happens when I'm having a bad day and someone wants to talk to me about joy, which I'm having an okay day. But I think that it's really not about, are you ecstatic or are you so down? I think it's about your capacity to feel. And that is uncontainable. Maybe it's easier to recognize when we really feel super sad as a songwriter, mm-hmm. because the light suddenly is more beautiful and you're the main character of the movie and it's raining. Maybe that's just me.
Is this The Notebook?
Yeah, it's like someone's calling to you. But I think noticing when life's really great is something to write about too.
How did you think about which parts of your life you wanted to share with listeners and which parts you didn't want to share? I mean, there's moments on this album, you know, I love lyrics that don't feel like lyrics.
Okay.
You know, like when you say,
what do I have?
I know there's times I can be a lot to handle and I'm working with a therapist to take care of it, right? It almost just sounds like a sentence until you sing it.
Yeah.
How do you think about what you want to put out there and what you don't?
I mean, this is definitely, this is the most vulnerable record I've ever made. I think part of that was because of the pandemic. I mean, I really came back to making music like I made my first records when I was 17. Like I had a little studio in my parents' bedroom and I was writing songs just to move through. I wasn't thinking about an audience. I was just thinking about what the truth of my life was and mm-hmm. what I needed to say in order to be able to externalize it and understand it outside of my body. It's sort of been a different experience releasing this record because it's so private. Mm. I mean, I name check the person my best friend masturbates to. Like, it's private.
Check, please.
Yeah.
And I believe Robert Pattinson is Robert here tonight Pattinson. In the building. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
There's been a much larger like mourning phase in putting out this record and having to really like it. I think we all got like a little bit emotionally attached to some things in the pandemic, and like I put everything I had into this record. So it's been a different experience to release it. But as far as what I choose to share and what I don't, when I make a record, I really think about making a record of a period of time. Hmm. And so when I like play back the highlight real, there are just moments that stand out in my memory. Or I use records to write a letter to someone. And the lyric you reference is a song called Symphony, where I was really speaking to a loved one and saying, like, hey, it's going to be okay. Hmm. I feel like a lot of my songs are me trying to be like, it's going to be fine.
Do you think, as a music historian, do you think we're going to look back on this era and see it as an era when there was a bunch of kind of pandemic-related music made?
I think that, you know, before 2020, maybe 1969 was probably like the banner year that people remember most in history, but there's literally no way that you can. It's almost like I feel like this entire decade will be a paradigm shift and sort of a redefining of what is expressed. Like just the fact that she feels free enough to be honest about her emotions. You know, I mean, and I know we've had the term emo or whatever in music or whatnot, but normally it's almost like a way to ridicule.
Like, not for me.
Well, at least way back in the day, like if anyone, like emotions, especially, you know, like black people invented cool seems what it's supposed to be, cool, but really cool is a defensive mechanism, which means like, I can't show you emotions. Like you don't, my poker face.
Right.
Like, oh man, he's so cool. Like cool is holding things back.
Right.
And those things means emotions. And so, I'm really glad that there are now people that are willing to take the sledgehammer and just break the walls down because, you know, as she said, like a lot of people in my generation are suffering greatly because they don't feel safe or the ability to express who they are or what they feel. Hmm. And so I think this is an important step.
So I got some questions from the audience that are popping up on my iPad. Someone wants to know, anonymously, Have you found it difficult to discuss your sense of spirituality with the people around you?
In our everyday lives?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't shut up about it. Like, I don't want to be that guy that, like, you know, I hate to use this cliche. Like, I had uncles that, like, came home from jail mm-hmm. and, like, they'll be, like, super hardcore, like, Muslim and all those things. And then, you know, like, they'll be on fire for maybe 7 years and then they'll slack off and, you know, everyone backslides or whatever. But for me, I think I found spirituality more. And spirituality is basically tuning into yourself mm-hmm. and finding yourself. You go inward with spirituality. And I think, you know, for me, I've kind of been on fire about it. So I guess those in my circle kind of do a proverbial eye roll. Oh, here he comes again. Yes, we're meditating, Amir. Like, that sort of thing. But I think it's also important because, you know, I'm in a genre and I come from a people in which by my age, I mean, well, you know, back when the Roots started and we were in our 20s, like, not getting shot at the club was like the life goal. We're like, all right, we're not going to get shot in the park, you know. And then we turn 35 and it's like, oh, damn, there's a new thing. We got to not get cardiac arrest and we got to take care of ourselves. And but, you know, by the time a lot of my contemporaries, like the fact that Flavor Flav is 63 is one of the greatest things that I've ever heard in my life.
Yes.
Because, you know, like the fact that anybody that makes it over 60, like Ice-T, Chuck D, Flavor Flav, like, I'm so happy because a lot of us are just succumbing at 51, 52, 53, 54. And, you know, I would have been, unfortunately, in that list if it weren't for the world stopping and for me to really take an assessment of what my life was for those five decades before. Mm. So, yeah, but people are tired of me, like, wake up, you know, that sort of thing, you know.
My friends and I all feel fairly existential, so it feels like a really natural conversation. And also, I've been in deep conversation about systems and of how we find meaning. Like, that's all I've talked about. I was with a close friend of mine in the music world who the other day was like, do you ever wonder, like, why it all happens? I was like, yeah, it's like all I've thought about for a year. It's like, it's my, yes. Like,
why it all, your success or why your life is where it's...
I mean, I think to me, this is the interesting part because music is not a job. It's a way of being. Like, it's a part of... You, I mean, to me at least.
I'm glad you know that at 20 because I had to learn that at 50. You know.
Well, I know it because I feel it so inherently, and that has been something I'm thinking a lot about. Sorry, I got so in it that I don't remember what I was talking about. But music rocks. Like, yeah.
Great deflection. All right, good.
Yeah.
I love this question. Someone writes, I'm here with my dad, and we've been talking a lot about how upbringings and family relationships shape our trajectories, our lives, our future relationships. How would you say your parents, family, friends have affected you and your lives and your music? Big question.
It's a memoir.
I'll read it.
Do you want me to go first while you think of an answer?
Music rock.
Professor Questlove.
Most people that know me. Yo, I'm forever going to use that as a way to... Look over there, music rocks! And leave. I tell people all the time, like I always attribute these two things to why I am the way I am about music. One, you know, I grew up in a show business family and, you know, rule number one in my household, especially when you're the youngest person, I lived in a don't touch my stereo household. Hmm. So as a result, I would love to make people think that, yes, at the age of three, I knew the entire Nat King Cole catalog and, you know, the entire history of Weather Report and Miles Davis. But the fact of the matter is that I wasn't allowed to touch the record player. And I had, you know, some sort of Stockholm syndrome way, like with my sister and my father and my mother hogging the stereo, I had to take in all the music that they kept feeding me and force feeding me. And, you know, it's like a musical version of foie gras or whatever. And so, wait, even I was impressed with that one.
That's sorry.
You know, and then by the time I'm 16, when like a lot of hip hop is sampling those records, then suddenly it was like, oh, I'm the smartest guy in the world because I know what this music came from. But, you know, it's that, and it's also the fact that my dad didn't believe in babysitters. Like, babysitters really wasn't a thing until the late 80s. Like, a stranger watching my kid while I'm on the road. So I had to get on the job training. And as an oldies doo-wop singer, you know, I was a seven-year-old in these nightclubs making myself busy. Like all of this. Like, I would cut light gels. Like, what 10-year-old you know is allowed to walk into a bar and, like, okay, get a ladder and start marking? That was my job, like, to set the monitors, and I would operate. Like, I was the richest fourth grader ever, you know? I made $300 a week back in 1980, and
damn,
that's because my dad, I had to work. It's like a farm. Like, I had to work. So between not believing in babysitters, between don't touch my stereo and no babysitters, like, that's how this knowledge was sort of fed to me. I would like to think that I would have reached here on my own, but chances are probably not.
I don't know. I think I'm really at the beginning of thinking about this question in general. I have, when I think about this question, I really, like, I was afforded the time, effort, resources, energy, and love from my parents to be able to really explore what I was passionate about. And that was sort of the greatest privilege or gift. And there weren't people in my family who were specifically interested in music. So it was really something I took ownership of. And when Heard It in a Past Life came out, my mom called me and she was like, I hope you know that you did this. And that, like, you were the one that asked for piano lessons. You were the one that, like, applied to music summer camps behind our back. Like, you were the one that made this happen.
Oh, in a nice way.
Yeah. Yeah, in the nice way.
Not in a, like, this was your idea.
No, in just, like, I hope you take a moment to really appreciate this because this was something you really, like, intuitively pushed for.
Hmm. Before I get off stage, I just wanted to thank you, Maggie, and Questlove for being here. And of course, thanks to everyone for coming out.
That's staff writer Kelly Fasane talking with Questlove and Maggie Rogers at a New Yorker live event this month. And we're going to leave you now with a performance from Rogers. It's the last song on her new album, Surrender. The song is called Different Kind of World.
One last song, I'll write a song and make it a song for peace. Though we all may carry on, may we do so decently. My hands are shaking, palms are sweating, thinking about the state of the world. When we're different kind of world.
Maggie Rogers playing Different Kind of World. To learn about many more live conversations, performances, and screenings, please check out the New Yorker Festival, which is taking place October 7th to October 9th. And all the details are at newyorker.com/festival. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. And stick around for my conversation with Roger Federer, who's announced his retirement from tennis after a truly epic career. That's all in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For anyone who cares about the sport of tennis, it's been a rough couple of weeks. Two of the all-time greats have retired, leaving a hole in the game the size of I don't know what. Serena Williams has played what's likely her last tournament, the U.S. Open, and Roger Federer is playing his last match at a tournament in London. When I talked with Federer a few years ago, he was 38 and already contemplating what his exit would look like. But he was still playing like a champion at that time. He spent 310 weeks ranked number one in the world and won a staggering 20 Grand Slam singles titles. Watching him was to watch a magician. And over a long career, he demonstrated an unmatchable court intelligence and temperament. I spoke with Roger Federer in our studio in 2019 when he was here for the U.S. Open. Some fans may not know that when you were a kid, you had a pretty volcanic temper on the court, and you willed that away. When you watched John McEnroe play, or now Nick Kyrgios or somebody like that, you see them lose it on the court. How do you relate to that kind of temperament on the court, which is so alien to you?
Well, I laugh about it because I think it's actually good. It's good that guys are showing their temper. I can totally relate to it because that's how I felt when I was younger. And it's nice to see it still exists. I'm also sometimes more like this.
You used to smash rackets.
I used to smash rackets, throw rackets, but very clever, you know, so I wouldn't break the racket. So I would throw it into the fence, or I would throw it over the fence or into the tree, or I don't know what I would do, but not onto the ground where it would break and I would have to explain myself to my parents and my sponsor maybe and ask for another racket because I smashed it. So I don't know. Look, I understand that people get upset because it happens to me still in practice nowadays. You know, when nobody's watching, I get super frustrated as well sometimes because tennis is just a sport where you're going to make mistakes. I don't care who you are. They just happen, you know. I just didn't want to be that kind of player with that attitude because I just felt like so drained once I was like midway through a tournament. I was so tired from getting upset, from shouting, commentating every ball I missed or, you know, for the sake of winning, I changed my attitude. I think basically that's what I did.
Athletes who have a long career change. Muhammad Ali, when he started off as a professional fighter, was just unbelievably fast. He had the speed of a lightweight and the power of a heavyweight. Later on, he changed his tactics. He became more of he paced himself differently. As a tennis player and somebody who's 38, what is it that you cannot do anymore? What have you had to give up?
Well, for me, it's been not sad, but a bit unfortunate that I had to give up, you know, in my spare time going to do other sports. You know, when I was younger, I remember I used to go play squash with my friends for hours after a game, or I would go play ping pong even before a match. or I used to go skiing, you know, after the Australian Open back in Switzerland. And all of a sudden you're like, well, maybe I should stop that just because I don't want to end my career that way. I don't want to break my knee. Or, and then you give it up and actually you realize, well, I can find something else that's a lot of fun. You organize your life differently. All of a sudden you have children. So instead of going, I don't know where we're going to play squash, well, now you maybe go run around in the park and play hide and seek and play catch, you know. So I don't know, it becomes a totally different life that you're living. But yeah, I mean, I do miss, you know, the years where I was a teenager too, and I just did anything just because I could, and I was still trying to understand what does professionalism really mean.
I notice sometimes at a tournament, you'll drop a set and pretty decisively in the very beginning. You're almost getting warmed up and you start to think, well, maybe the difference between Federer and this other guy who's playing is not so significant. And then the tide just completely turns, which leads me to think that maybe the biggest difference between somebody who's at your level or Djokovic's level or Nadal's and then the next layer down is more mental than physical. Do you see that that's the case?
Not so much, to be honest. I think actually margins are much slimmer than people think they are. If you win 53% or 55% of the points, you are winning the match and actually dominating if you're winning 55 or 60% of the points played. And if I'd asked you now, like how much do you think I win of all the points played, you would think maybe 70% if you're winning 6-4, 6-3, but actually it's much less than that. You know, and I think what you want to try to create as a player is that you're not playing at the limit of things, that your base is so high that you can always rely on it, and that you have several strengths, you know, in your game, that if one also goes away, that you still can absorb it with a different shot, let's say. And I think that's what separates the absolute greats and the best of our game to the other players, you know, is that we can rely on several things to keep us alive in a match.
What drives your obsession for tennis right now? Is it records? Is it do you need the thrill of winning a tournament over and over again? Is it money? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the motivation can be records. Sometimes it is beating, you know, the new generation. Sometimes it is proving to myself that I can do it again. And I mean, just in my heart, I just like playing tennis. You know, it may be practice or matches. I like being out there, you know, and as long as I'm really enjoying myself and I feel that way, I think it's nice to keep on playing and sort of really squeezing that last drop of lemon out of it, you know, and not leaving the game of tennis feeling like, I could have or should have stayed longer, you know, on the tour because, you know, I feel like I've missed out.
Now, when you're playing, you've got a life of activity and busyness and upheaval and attention and press and all the rest. And then when you stop, you stop. When you think ahead to that point, whatever it is, when you're 40, when you're 45, God knows, what will life be like? And are you looking forward to that?
It will be different. It will be different for sure. You know, I don't think I will have a major struggle being away from the game of tennis that I love so much, because I feel like I was able to keep really great friendships throughout my career. So I think that's gonna catch me in a nice way, coming back to a more normal life, a more structured life. You know, I think I'll be, you know, in business in some shape or form. I hope to be in tennis also, just at least a little bit. I could see myself in a mentoring role. I don't see myself commentating or coaching per se, but, you know, helping and giving tips and advice, totally I can see that. Philanthropy, of course, my foundation, super important to me. So I know I will be doing that in the future. And I know I will be living in Switzerland, my home, where all my friends are. I love my country so much.
Now, David Foster Wallace, who we remember best as a novelist, also wrote a lot about tennis. And he was a big tennis player. And he was a fan of yours. And that's putting it lightly. In a piece in the New York Times, he said that watching you play tennis was like a religious experience, and that on the court that you looked like, and I'm quoting here, a creature whose body is both flesh and somehow light. How do you respond when somebody writes something like that about you? Is it thrilling or embarrassing or what?
Yeah, it's a bit embarrassing. I remember the interview with him, and I walked away from the interview thinking like, oh, I don't know if this piece is going to be a most incredible piece or the worst piece. It was really hard to tell, you know, and he wrote this most unbelievable piece about me that almost got me definitely a bit embarrassed, you know, because at the end of the day, I'm just a tennis player, you know, but I know that tennis in the theater sort of feeling we have, you know, we can hear a pin drop. It can be quite a magical sort of feeling, you know, for somebody who's not a tennis player. And even for us, it's a great reminder sometimes playing these great arenas around the world, what people think and feel watching sports. And I get it too, because I'm also a sports fan. I also watch it, and I get maybe more nervous watching other sports than actually playing it myself.
Roger Federer. We spoke in 2019. This weekend's Laver Cup in London will be his final tournament. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele,
along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli. Thanks also this week to David Ohana. The New Yorker Live event was recorded by Ed Haber and Irene Trudell.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.